Could a supposedly intelligent species make the world's oceans more acidic? It sounds like science fiction, but now it is science. Our guest is Dr. Richard A. Feeley, an oceanographer at the NOAA Pacific Marine Laboratory in Seattle and a fellow of the American Geophysical Union. He specializes in the way carbon cycles in the sea and ocean acidification. Welcome, Dr. Feeley, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, ocean acidification, it doesn't sound easy to describe to a stranger on the street. Could you take a shot at a short description of the problem for us?
Sure, I'd love to. As we burn coal and oil and natural gas and gasoline for fuel and energy, all that carbon dioxide is released into the atmosphere. And over the past 200 years or so, we've released somewhere in the neighborhood of about 540 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And about a third of that has been taken up by the oceans. And since carbon dioxide is a gas that immediately reacts with the water of seawater, it forms a weak acid called carbonic acid. And carbonic acid quickly dissociates and releases a hydrodyne, which gives the oceans its acidity. And this increase in the carbonic acid over that amount of time has increased the acidity of the ocean by about 30% over the last 200 years. And with the projections of the use of fossil fuel in the future, using the IPCC scenarios for the business as usual, we could see increases of acidity as much as 150% by the end of this century. And that's what's causing the concerns of the marine scientists about the impacts of this changing acidity on the ocean biota.
It sounds to me like a huge uncontrolled chemistry experiment. Eventually that could have a big impact, but is ocean acidification already happening?
Oh, yes. We have actually been able to measure the changes that have taken place in seawater. I spent most of my career studying these changes, and we have the measurement capability to actually see these changes over time, and we have been doing so throughout most of the world oceans, and they are quite significant. Throughout my career of the past 20 years or so, we've seen changes of pH as much as about 0.04 pH units over that time frame alone. Basically a 6% change in the acidity over the last 15 years. So these are measurable changes that we can see, and some recent papers have suggested that they're starting to have some very significant impacts on marine organisms. Now, since carbonic acid's a weak acid, one of the first things it does, it tends to combine with a species called carbonate ion. And carbonate ion is one of the building blocks for calcium carbonate-forming organisms, such as snails and shelled organisms, such as lobsters and abalone and oysters. And as they concentration of carbonate ion decreases, and it's already decreased about 16% since the pre-industrial period, it's more difficult for them to produce their shells and skeletons, and they tend to become thinner and they grow more slowly. Well, for a coral reef organism, for example, which makes its entire skeleton out of calcium carbonate, growing slowly is a difficult problem for them because they have to continue to grow at a fast rate in order to grow and keep up with sea level rise. And so if they tend to slow down, as we're seeing over the last 15 years that they are slowing down, then they have a problem maintaining their livelihood and their coral structures and keeping up with sea level rise. That's one example. Other species like foraminifera and pteropods, which are marine snails that live in the water column, their shells are beginning to become thinner and more brittle, and they can begin to break apart very quickly. And we're seeing evidence of that occurring in the high northern and high southern latitudes right now.
Well, you've mentioned these very tiny shell forming. I guess, are they plankton, really?
Yes. Pteropods, for example, are real small, tiny snail-like creatures. They're about as big as the size of your baby finger fingernail. You can mm-hmm. see them with your naked eye. The foot of the snail has been modified into a swimming structure, and they swim quite well with the foot, and they tend to stay deep in the water column during the day to avoid predation by fish, and then they come up to the night to feed. And these pteropods, for example, are primary food sources for juvenile salmon and pollock and other species that are of particular importance to the United States fisheries. And in fact, this pink salmon in particular, that's 60% of the diet of the juvenile pink salmon in the wintertime. And these pteropods are very, very sensitive to changes. When they get into the corrosive waters that can exist in our high northern latitudes, the shells begin to dissolve within 48 hours.
Wow, so it's affecting things further up the food chain. And I've also been told that these very tiny creatures may grab anywhere from 25 to 50% of the carbon from the ocean, so they may be important agents of climate control here on Earth. Am I getting that picture correctly?
Well, I haven't heard those numbers before, so I can't verify that particular estimate. That seems high to me. Basically, we consider there's two processes by which carbon dioxide are removed from the surface ocean. One is by the biology, as you just mentioned, and the other is by the ventilation, that is the circulation between the surface ocean and the deeper oceans. And both those processes are important. And so any changes to the biology, we can affect that capability, that feedback mechanism for carbon being released from the ocean back to the atmosphere. So that's a very serious concern that the modelers are working with right now, is how these feedback mechanisms will work in a high CO2 world.
I've also read in a journal, Nature Geoscience, a Tasmanian report about the same problem happening in the southern oceans. So it's not something, though, that's just happening far away. You've been doing some research here in North America?
Yes. Well, this is a global problem. It happens everywhere. More CO2 tends to go into the oceans at high latitudes because CO2 is more soluble the colder the water is. So there is significant concern about what's happening in the Arctic and in the Antarctic regions. And in fact, those regions would be considered to be the regions where corrosive waters might reach the surface first. But what we found is off the coast of Washington, Oregon, and California, there's another return mechanism where the ocean acidified waters gets returned to the coast, and this is a process called upwelling. And what happens there is that along our coast, the winds shift to the north from the northwest in the summertime. And when that happens, the surface waters are pushed offshore, and the subsurface waters are pulled on the shore. And the subsurface waters come from a depth about 150 to 200 meters. So they're essentially right at the shelf break, and then they get pulled all the way to the beach and all the way to the surface. And what we found was that these subsurface waters were enriched in anthropogenic CO2 and were corrosive to these calcium carbonate-forming species. And we found these waters actually reaching the surface off of Northern California. And this process occurs anywhere from April to September or October. And so we're seeing corrosive waters now when the models would have predicted that we wouldn't see them until the end of the century. So we have to take into account these additional processes of upwelling and how that might accelerate the impacts of ocean acidification.
Well, as always, nature is a bit more complex than we thought. We're talking with Ocean Specialist Dr. Richard A. Feely. And Dr. Feely, I'd like to verge off just a little bit from this into the idea of geoengineering. We just had a project, the LOHFX project, where they tried to stimulate algae growth with iron and wasn't really that successful. But it seems to me almost all the geoengineering suggestions, whether it's blasting sulfates or seawater into the sky or throwing up deflecting mirrors, they don't deal with this problem that we're talking about of carbon going into the ocean more and more. I wonder if these alleged solutions are just going to dump more carbon into the sea.
Well, that's one of the concerns that we have with geoengineering that try to solve the temperature problem but don't deal with the major cause of global warming, which is the release of CO2 emissions into the atmosphere. And by just addressing, say, the symptoms and not addressing the cause, we end up with higher CO2 levels in the atmosphere and therefore more severe problems for ocean acidification and the organisms that live in the oceans. And I think that a lot of us are very concerned that these geoengineering approaches don't take into account the ocean acidification issue, and they need to do so.
You know, I wonder if we asked 10 people in the street about ocean acidification, whether we'd find even one that's knew about it or was really concerned about it. It hasn't hit the world media the way the polar bears or some other signs of climate change have. There were scientists at the Copenhagen summit recently that brought this up, and they're saying that we're returning possibly to ocean conditions not seen since the time of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Is there a possibility this could lead to mass extinctions as happened then?
Well, there's a considerable difference in what we're doing now as compared with the processes that occurred 65 million years ago. For one thing, we're releasing CO2 in the atmosphere at a rate that's literally tens to 100 times faster than these geological processes that occurred in the past. And that's particularly important because that means that most of the CO2 still resides in the upper ocean. In fact, most of the anthropogenic CO2 resides in the upper 1,500 meters of the ocean right now. And it takes several hundred years for that anthropogenic CO2 to get to the bottom of the ocean and circulate. And that circulation problem is particularly important because the way you neutralize this anthropogenic CO2 is by reaction with the carbonate species, the dead shells in the bottom of the ocean. And then that neutralizes the CO2 and returns alkalinity to the seawater. But this process takes several circuits of the ocean and essentially thousands of years for it to occur. So if you release CO2 in the atmosphere very, very rapidly, the oceans do not have enough time to absorb all that CO2 and neutralize it by reaction with deep sea sediments. And this is how the oceans dealt with this problem in the past, is they basically had enough time to neutralize a lot of that CO2. And mankind really isn't allowing the oceans to do that, so it tends to build up in the surface ocean and basically can cause more severe problems over the next 200 years or so than what we experienced in the past. So the analogies are not perfect. We're stressing the oceans much more significantly than had occurred in the past. Nevertheless, if you look in the geological record and look at these past extinction events, what you find is that in each case, and there's five major extinction events that took place, each of those five major extinction events were associated with a major ocean acidification event as well. Their CO2 concentrations were many times higher than they are today. And associated with each of those extinction events was a tremendous loss of the calcium carbonate species, both coral reef species and in many cases, and sometimes some of the benthic species as well. And, for example, during the KT boundary 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs died, we lost about 95% of the coral reef species. And it took anywhere from 2 to 18 million years for them to re-evolve. And so the kinds of processes that would cause ocean acidification could cause a loss of many, many species of organisms in the sea. And it basically would be many millions of years before they would return in some form that's similar to what we're experiencing on Earth now. So I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm so concerned about this problem, because the decisions that we make about CO2 emissions and the potential impacts of CO2 emissions could have far-reaching impacts on our ocean ecosystems for many hundreds of thousands to millions of years.
And scientists are raising the warning flag about ocean acidification. You have the Monaco Declaration released in January saying that acidification is accelerating and severe damages are imminent. Are you part of a group of scientists who are trying to get this message out?
Yes, I am. I was a co-signer of that declaration, and there are about two or three similar declarations that have taken place. That's the most noteworthy declaration. There's also a very recent movie, the documentary, a full-length documentary called A Sea Change that just was released last month in Washington, D.C. It's a wonderful documentary about ocean acidification. It's primarily geared at the layperson so they can understand it easily and understand the potential impacts of ocean acidification. And also gives us some solutions about what would happen if we chose to move towards alternative sources of energy and how we might do that. So it gives us a very positive and constructive means of thinking about how we might consider our energy choices of the future.
Well, who put out the video Sea Change, and how could we find it?
It was put out by Barbara Ettinger and Sven Husaby of Niji Films. And if you just Google A Sea Change, it will come right up.
All right. And do you have other suggestions on what listeners could do to find out more about ocean acidification?
Yes. If you go to my webpage at Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, so it's pmel.noaa.gov, and you look in the front page for ocean acidification, I have all sorts of useful information and research reports and documentaries and some videos.
Is there anything we've missed or a message that you'd like to add at this time?
Just as I said towards the end of my conversation, is that we're really at a turning point as humankind. If we continue to burn fossil fuel for oil and from oil and gas and for energy, then we will be continuing to release CO2 in the atmosphere at a rate that many of our marine ecosystems cannot respond to, and it's our concern that the changes could be quite dramatic and have significant impact on our food resources from the sea and many of the population of the island nations throughout the world are directly dependent on these food resources. Approximately a third of the population of the world depends on food resources from sea for as much as 25% of their protein resources. So this is a very important security issue in terms of food security for our population. And I think we need to take serious concern about what we're doing with our ocean ecosystems.
We've been chatting with Dr. Richard A. Feely from the NOAA Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in Seattle. Dr. Feely, thank you for spending your valuable time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. Broadcast on 16 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive.